is radio fax 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you would like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
Now, Andy Burnham looks at one of the most popular shortwave portables available in the United Kingdom.
I've been interested in DXing for quite a long time, using various lash-ups consisting of scrounged shortwave trannies, half-dead valve sets dating from the 40s, 50s and 60s, and huge wires around the garden that drove my family to distraction. So to celebrate the arrival of my autumn grant check, I lashed out in an almost unprecedented fashion and went digital with a SciShow PLL quartz synthesized world band receiver bought from the local Dixons. It's a travel portable measuring 300 by 160 by 60 millimetres, based on the famous Sony ICF 2001. It's also sold as the Siemens RK6414, the Supertech SR16H, the Edvis RX33, the Ambassador 2020, etc. It tunes from 150 kHz to 30 MHz AM and FM 88 to 108 MHz with a stereo decoder, something most of the opposition don't possess. There's also a B VFO for SSB reception. 9 presets. Tuning is via a keypad, analog-style dial or automatic scanning, and it has a very clear LCD display showing the shortwave band you're currently on and a large frequency or time readout. As a bonus, you can use it as a clock radio, as it has alarm and sleep facilities. So the big question was, would it pick up radio fax? The answer is yes, on shortwave, otherwise I wouldn't have bought it. Now I can pick up stations that I struggled to previously, mainly due to the good selectivity and switchable 7 or 2.8 kHz shortwave filter. Medium wave is much less sensitive due to the wideband design of the FET buffered internal ferrite aerial. Sensitivity can be improved with active strap-on attachment aerials, etc., and long wires. So, more importantly, the selectivity is good, and the AGC also works effectively most of the time. After hearing nightmare stories of a friend's old Sony ICF eating batteries in about 4 hours, I was relieved to see that the normal current consumption is about 100 milliamps, and there's the statutory 9-volt connector on the side. My set of D-size cells has been going strong for ages, so fingers crossed. As well as the 6 main batteries, 2 AA cells provide memory backup. The receiver works by double conversion, first to about 40 MHz, then 455 kHz. The image rejection is quoted as modest, but I haven't encountered any problems as yet. So, all in all, the RF and IF detection is pretty good. My only real whinge is the rather hissy audio you get with the internal amplifier. However, the signal from the DIN record out connector is good enough to use as a hi-fi tuner. The speaker itself is good and can provide a fair amount of power when required. In its favour, it has far fewer controls than the Sony ICF 2001 without losing the features. The display is also clearer and larger, although this simplicity means that it only tunes in 1 kHz steps, making it unsuitable for RTTY unless you're a masochist. Resolution of the signal strength meter is poor, with only 5 LEDs, but I consoled myself by thinking of all the power I was saving due to this. So in conclusion, the SciShow SW5000 is recommended to people on a fairly modest budget and is available from Dixon's for $99.95. We know of many RadioFax listeners using these sets, so you'll be in good company owning one. The quote from Trevor Brook is that to get better performance you'd have to spend about £350, so I think that's pretty good value.
Did I really say that? And now a new item about the early history of radar from the IEEE Review. The Royal Signals and Radar Establishment today is one of the foremost research establishments of its kind in the world. Its history can be traced to a solitary army officer in 1903. The RSRE, a brief history from earliest times to the present day, by D.H. Tomlin. Research and development is considered to be an essential ingredient of all industrial activity in the 1980s. Yet, of all the resources spent on it, a large proportion is still directed to military requirements. It is therefore surprising to find that this is a recent phenomenon. At the turn of the century, little was spent on military R&D, and of those involved, most were within the armed services. Civilian participation came about only after the First World War, when a few servicemen who had been involved in experiments during the war were demobilised in post. Civilian recruitment only slowly became the norm later. An article of this length cannot hope to look at all aspects of UK R&D through the ages. Rather, it will show the steps which led to the present single conglomerate, the Royal Signals and Radar Establishment, in Malvern, Worcestershire. The more recent events may be remembered. The Royal Radar Establishment was formed by the amalgamation of the Radar Research and Development Establishment, working mainly for the Army, and the Telecommunication Research Establishment, supporting the RAF, in 1952. In 1975, the RRE was joined by the Signals Research and Development Establishment, Army, and the Services Electronic Research Laboratory, forming the RSRE. But how did these original establishments come about? All but the TRE started life as internal service organisations operated by military personnel. Of the four, the oldest was the Signals Establishment. Wireless communication was becoming a reality by 1900, mainly because Marconi was employing private resources to carry out his experiments. In the United Kingdom, some interest was being shown by the Navy, which saw this new medium as a possible means of communicating with distant vessels. The Navy was buying equipment from Marconi for evaluation purposes, and in order to protect its interests, concluded an agreement with Marconi, making the Navy the sole purchasing agent for the British government. It was argued that only the Navy could have any need for long-distance communication. The Army slowly realised the value, however, and in May 1903 set up a small team consisting of one Captain Halliday with the title Officer Commanding Wireless Experiments to test commercial equipment for suitability for Army use and to recommend improvements. He was a Royal Engineer based at the School of Military Engineering at Chatham, and unfortunately we know little else about him. He was almost certainly in the electrical branch, possibly with telegraph experience, but whether this included wireless telegraphy, or whether he had been one of the RE observers at Bristol or Bath during the Marconi trials, is not known. He was to stay only 6 months, after which a series of other short-term appointments were made. It is possible that these early tests were used mainly for familiarisation purposes. Because of the Navy agreement, only equipment from other makers could be obtained and tested, all proving inferior to Marconi equipment. Later in 1903, the still small section moved to Aldershot, where it stayed until 1914, when it moved to Woolwich Arsenal, and in 1916 to Woolwich Common. Here it acquired the title of the Signals Experimental Establishment and became the first services-based organisation to be recognised as set up for experimental work. At Aldershot, a section had been involved in experiments with ground-to-air, air-to-air and air-to-ground wireless equipment. However, the heavy army sets were totally unusable for airborne use in the low-powered aircraft of the time. This section, responsible for testing the equipment for RFC use, moved to a small airfield at Joyce Green near Dartford, set in the marshlands at the side of the Thames and subject to almost continuous fog. Here, assisted by enthusiastic RFC officers, the work took on a development role, as well as purely testing, the latter being frustrated by the flying conditions. And in 1916, it moved to Biggin Hill, where a brand new airfield was created, one which was to become world famous during the Second World War. During the SEE stay at Woolwich, it was responsible for all Army signals requirements, wireless, acoustics and landline, and developed mobile, field and fixed wireless telegraphy and telephony wireless sets and cabled telephone sets, outstanding among which was the Tele-F set. Metal and mine detection also fell within its sphere of study. The Army was obsessed with robustness in its equipment, and this involved weight. A 1 kilowatt telegraph set in 1918 weighed over a ton. A 25-watt set in 1930 required 3 mules to carry it. The establishment moved in 1943 to Christchurch to occupy a site vacated by the Air Defence Research and Development Establishment, which had been evacuated to Malvern. Precautions were taken to move sensitive sections to an outstation a few miles inland. The move was accompanied by the installation of Professor J.D. Cockcroft as Chief Superintendent, in parallel with the same post held already at ADRDE. There was a rapid turn towards miniaturisation and the use of microwaves. Some of the radar staff, versed in electronic wizardry, moved with him from Malvern and developed the No. 10 set, which was the first ever pulse-width modulated, pulse-multiplexed telephony equipment using microwaves in 1944. One of Cockcroft's first innovations was to have the name changed to the Signals Research and Development Establishment. Up to 1943, the SEE had been an experimental station, i.e. directly responsible for specifying and testing commercial equipment, and not for research and development. Cockcroft introduced the concept, as he had previously done for the Air Defence Experimental Establishment, that one organisation should be responsible for all stages, from conception and research to production and testing. After the war, the SRDE was in the forefront of research in satellite communication for field army use and advanced communication security.
Your day breaks, your mind aches, you find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up, she takes her time and doesn't feel she has to hurry. She no longer needs you, and in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of tears cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years. You want her, you need her, and yet you don't believe her when she says her love is dead. You think she needs you. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years. You stay home, she goes out, she says that long ago she knew someone, but now he's gone, she doesn't need him. Your day breaks, your mind aches, there will be times when said will fill your head, you won't forget her, and in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years.
By 1917, London had been bombed by both aircraft and Zeppelin, and defence was necessary from ground and air. Army defences were concentrated on the coast against surface attack. They used searchlights to sweep the sea and naval guns for response. These defences were drawn back to London and other cities. The elevation traverses of both were increased, and some crude sound locators were devised without any form of prediction. All this was pretty ineffective, but good for morale. Fighter aircraft were deployed, but at night these were dependent on the illumination of targets by searchlights, which were notoriously unreliable, owing mainly to arc instability. In 1917, a small section of Army searchlight technicians were given the task of improving the arcs. The Army Searchlight Group had originally been set up in 1897 as the London Electrical Engineers, Royal Engineers Volunteers, drawn from the Society of Telegraph Engineers, a forerunner of the present Institution of Electrical Engineers. Dr. Hopkinson was the head of the investigating group, and Captain Paley York in charge of the experiments. They soon found a solution to the problem by introducing a metal centre to the carbons, a method patented worldwide, which made early cinema projectors feasible. The group was intended to work for a year, but its work was so effective that the life was extended, and by late 1917 it had been named the Searchlight Experimental Section and was based in Victoria, London. In 1922, all air defence work was concentrated in one place, at the Air Defence Experimental Establishment, now based at Biggin Hill, and embracing the searchlight and the acoustics sections of the Signals Experimental Establishment. The searchlight group had been civilianised in 1919 when the army members were demobilised, and the establishment became entirely civilian, but retaining an army commandant. The significance of this was that the scientific direction became stable, whereas at SEE, where the senior scientific posts were still army, the direction was interrupted every 2 to 3 years as personnel moved on. The Army and ADEE looked for ways of obtaining early warning of approaching aircraft. Radio detection had not been thought of, and at that time would have been impracticable, which left sight and sound. Both were deployed. Powerful wide-angle binoculars on stable mounts were devised, and acoustic mirrors were built, some of concrete, including a 200-foot aperture concrete mirror at Dungeness, which still exists, but in poor condition. It was proposed that a string of these be built around the Kent and Essex coast, but the Henderson disarmament plan of 1930 delayed this. One other large mirror had been built in Malta, when the idea was set up for renewal in 1936, on the same day that confirmation of the development of detection by radio came from Orford Ness. Sound was now superseded by radio. Their ranges were far too short, at an effective maximum of 15 miles, even for the aircraft of that time. However, the Army had developed an extensive reporting system, which remained in being until the outbreak of war in 1939. In 1939, the ADEE moved precipitously from Biggin Hill to Christchurch, to a home being built for it, but intended to be occupied at the end of 1940. Here in 1941, Cockcroft became Chief Superintendent, and the name changed to the Air Defence Research and Development Establishment. The magnetron first appeared in August 1940, and the next 12 months saw the establishment coming to grips with the new technique and planning its exploitation. In May 1942, yet another hasty move was made, following the Allied raid on Bruneval and Churchill's explicit instructions to, quote, move before the next full moon, this time to Malvern, to occupy a station built in 1938 as a dispersal point for the Home Office, and one of the present sites occupied by the RSRE. Here, many sophisticated radars were devised for army use in searchlight control, gun laying, mortar and shell trackers, and shell splash sets for coastal and harbour defence, while still improving searchlight and acoustic systems, including gun sound ranging. By 1943, however, it was evident that sound and searchlight detection had little more to add to a war scene, and the work was dropped. The establishment now concentrated solely on radar, becoming the Radar Research and Development Establishment. Cockcroft left to work on the atomic bomb and atomic energy in Canada in August 1944, and the work of RRDE, after providing crash support for the Army of Invasion, moved towards future peacetime military requirements. By 1952, it was obvious that the gun was outmoded for anti-aircraft defence, and AA Command was disbanded. The RRDE joined the Telecommunication Research Establishment to form the Radar Research Establishment, later to be given the Royal Accolade. Spark transmitters were the norm as late as the mid-1920s, but the thermionic valve had started to be used from the end of the First World War. The Navy saw the advantages, but the necessary high-power reliable valves were not available. In 1920, therefore, the Admiralty set up a small group located at the Signals School in Portsmouth to improve the valve. The section was so successful that it was called on to devise valves for all the services, and subsequently became the sole centre for the control of all services valve development. One of the important developments by the group was the introduction of silica envelopes for high-power valves in place of glass. This was particularly important in 1937, when the Chain Home CH system for the RAF and the CD and GL for the Army required valves of far higher powers than had previously been possible. At the start of the war in 1939, the group moved for safety to Waterlooville, where in 1941 it was joined by the groups working on radar. the complex became the Admiralty Signals Establishment. Separate from the Signals School, and the valve section was attached to it, but never actually joined. In 1945, the valve section, devoid of an official title, moved to Baldock and became the Inter-Service Electronic Research Laboratory. This was altogether too much of a mouthful and quickly changed to the Services Electronic Research Laboratory. Among other things, it was responsible for the complete revamp of the cavity magnetron, increasing the 10-centimetre power from 1 to 2.5 megawatts at a stroke. It conducted research on linear accelerators, masers and lasers. By 1975, its work was so interleaved with that at the RRE that amalgamation was inevitable. While the valve section had been tied to the Signals School, it had been inevitable that the majority of its personnel would be naval officers, and it was only the expansion of the 1930s and the move to Waterlooville which brought about civilianisation. Continuing in the final part of the history about the RSRE by D.H. Tomlin. Up to the mid-1930s, only sight and sound were available for detection of aircraft. Early warning of aircraft approach and approximate location is, however, a prerequisite for the deployment of fighter aircraft. In January 1935, the Tizard Committee was set up to consider how far recent advances in scientific and technical knowledge can be used to strengthen the present methods of defence against hostile aircraft, culminating in two papers being submitted by Robert Watson Watt, who headed the Radio Research Laboratory of the National Physical Laboratory. The first, in direct answer to a question from the committee, showed the impossibility of destroying man or machine by radio. The physiological effects part of this paper almost certainly came from Professor Hill, Professor of Biology at University College London, and a member of the committee. The second, prompted by a paragraph in the first, showed the possibility of detecting aircraft by radio. There is little doubt that the calculations and the draft papers were all prepared by Arnold Wilkins, one of Watson Watt's assistants, and signed and forwarded by Watson Watt. This is typical of procedure within the civil service at that time, whereby all communications had to be signed by a senior officer, or even the head of the establishment. Inevitably, he got the credit for any successful idea. The Tizard Committee requested a demonstration, and Wilkins arranged what has come to be known as the Daventry experiment. This showed that the interference between the direct and reflected waves from a radio transmitter could be detected, confirming the observations made in 1931 by Munford, Carter, Nancarrow and Mitchell, all engineers at the GPO research station at Dollis Hill, and an observation known to Wilkins and Watson Watt. Wilkins was a scientific officer working on radio propagation and ionospheric measurements under Watson Watt at the RRS, and had previously worked with Appleton on his ionospheric researches. A subsequent experiment, using a modified Slough RRS pulsed ionospheric sounding equipment, showed that the range of an aircraft could be measured, something which may already have been deduced from the appearance of aircraft tracks on some ionospheric traces. Subsequently, authority was given for a new establishment to be set up, initially at Orford Ness, where the first major experiment was so satisfactory that the 200-foot concrete sound locator project was abandoned. The new group soon moved to Bawdsey, occupying Bawdsey Manor, and the Bawdsey Research Station was born, where the CH system and its associated reporting system were devised. The War Office posted people from both the ADEE and SEE to observe and help with a mandate to design anti-aircraft and coastal defence systems. From this, the GL-1 and CD-1 were produced, the latter also being used by the RAF as chain home low to fill in the Lloyd's mirror gap in the CH polar diagram. By the end of 1937, the BRE had carried out airborne radar experiments for anti-surface vessel purposes, and the various radars were being produced in substantial numbers by September 1939. When the Bawdsey Research Station was created, Watson Watt moved from RRS to become its first head. Then, in 1939, he moved to the Air Ministry in London and was replaced by A.P. Rowe, who had been secretary to the Tizard Committee. He was to stay through the various subsequent moves of the establishment until after the war, and saw the enormous expansion of radar applied to military and later civilian uses. The BRE, by now rejoicing in the title of the Air Ministry Research Establishment, was moved hastily to Dundee at the outbreak of war, with disastrous consequences to morale of its workers. In 1940, the fragmented parts were reunited at Swanage, where airborne interception was brought into being at 200 MHz. The name changed yet again in January 1941 to the Telecommunications Research Establishment, heralding the period of microwave exploitation and the widening of the establishment's remit to include the development of beam and beacon systems, as well as the devising of means of destabilising enemy bombing aids. for the same reason that ADRDE moved to Malvern in May 1942, TRE also moved to Malvern and occupied the Boys' College. Here, all aspects of radar and radio, other than actual communications, were exploited in support of the RAF. The end of the war saw the TRE looking to the civil uses of radar, both airborne and for surveillance. For a short time, part of the early work of the AERE was based at the TRE until Harwell became available. By the end of 1945, the banished Boys' College was anxious to return to Malvern, and the TRE took over HMS Duke, a stoker's training school in Malvern, and the present main site of the RSRE. The amalgamation of the TRE and RRDE in 1952 was followed by the development of new generations of surveillance and guided weapon radars, and later the exploitation of infrared techniques, and now the overall combined establishment, the Royal Signals and Radar Establishment, is the premier centre for all aspects of electronics, computer and physics research. There's some details here also about early radar devised at the Bordsey Research Station. The first operational radars were the chain home for the RAF, operating mainly in the 10 to 20 metre band, and intended for long-range detection of raids, and to give a degree of position and strength. They were located in a band along the east and southeast coasts, from where the data were sent to a filter room and then a control room at Fighter Command, and thence vectors and other information were passed to airfields and fighter pilots. For the Army, there were two tasks. First, to provide a radar for coastal defence, met by a 150cm set with a rotatable aerial and known as CD1. Early in its testing, it was realised that, because of its short wavelength, it helped to fill in the rather large low elevation gap in the CH polar diagram. The RAF, therefore, adopted versions of the CD1 as the chain home low. The second Army requirement was an equipment to improve anti-aircraft gun laying, to get away from visual laying. This culminated in the GL-1, a semi-mobile two-cabin equipment operating in the 55 to 75 MHz region. The transmitter sported a single dipole on its roof, but the receiver had two dipoles abreast on the side of the rotatable cabin backed by mesh. This directional aerial was used to locate the bearing of an approaching aircraft, and the data passed, along with range, to predictors. Later, a third dipole was added above the others, whereby a measure of elevation was possible. This set was never very satisfactory, but a few aircraft were reputedly shot down using its data. Later sets were more satisfactory, as a move was made to centimetric wavelengths. While at Bordsey, the Air Ministry team started the experiments which were to lead to Airborne Aircraft Interception, AI, Anti-Surface Vessel, ASV, and Ground Mapping, to be known as H2S, equipments. Later versions of all these equipments were far more sophisticated and much more accurate as advantage was taken of centimetric wavelengths. All, however, depended heavily on rapid development of suitable valves by the valve section at the Signals School and later ASE, as well as industry. That was by D.H. Tomlin in IEE Review. And now, Eddie Caffrey with a million-selling single.
Lobo, Me and You and a Dog Named Boo. Released on the Big Three record label in America and Philips in Britain, in 1971. Written by Kent Lavoie, released in March 71 and in Britain May 71. It went to number 5 for 2 weeks in the American charts, spending a total of 11 weeks in the top 50, and number 4 for 1 week in Britain, also staying 11 weeks in the charts. Lobo, real name Kent Lavoie, was born in Tallahassee, Florida in 1944 of French Indian parentage. He played guitar, organ and piano. His early training on guitar, given to him during his early teens, came into use when he was at college. He became a professional singer-guitarist with beer bands while he was working his way through Florida colleges. After marriage, he settled in the Tampa, St. Petersburg, Clearwater Beach area and continued to earn a living from long-term engagements at local nightclubs. In one of these clubs in Tampa, he met Phil Gernhardt, producer of Stay by Morris Williams and the Zodiacs, Snoopy vs. the Red Baron by the Royal Guardsmen, and Dion's Abraham, Martin and John. Gernhardt signed him up. Lobo spent 3 years writing songs in between working, some of which were local releases cut in Atlanta, Georgia studio, before showing Gernhardt A Dog Named Boo. A master cut and a contract made with Big Tree Records in New York, a label which was eventually distributed by Bell in America and Philips in Britain. The success of Me and You and A Dog Named Boo firmly established Lobo as both artist and songwriter, resulting in TV, concert appearances and touring with his group in the USA and abroad. The million sale of the disc was reported in September 1971. Lobo chose the name for his billing so that if the record had flopped, he could start afresh without detriment to his real name. The name Lobo means wolf in Spanish and symbolized the image of being a loner, a lone wolf. Lobo became a successful writer of radio and TV jingles, preparing audio tapes and home-based four-track studio. Lobo, Me and You, and A Dog Named Boo.
I remember to this day the bright red Georgia clay, how it stuck to the tire after the summer rain. Will power me that old cargo. A woman's mind told me that so. Oh, how I wish we were back on the road again. Me and you and a dog named Boo, traveling and living off the land. Me and you and a dog named Boo, how I love being a free man.
Information-based radio, broadcasting to the people who really listen to shortwave. This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
Paul Stimpson went to the motor show at the National Exhibition Centre near Birmingham, England, and looked at some of the more technical aspects. He sends us this report.
At recent motor shows, various manufacturers have been making statements about their views of the future with concept cars. Arguably one of the most stunning of these is Citroën's new Activa. This four-door, four-seater bristles with the kind of advanced technology you would normally expect from the aircraft industry. Press remote control on the keyring and all the four doors spring open, and with the rear doors hinged at the back of the car and no central pillar between them, getting in and out is child's play. But it's beneath its sleek bodywork where the Activa impresses most. There's four-wheel drive to give you the best traction and four-wheel steering to give you the most manoeuvrability. Add to this a suspension which is controlled by a computer and electronic drive-by-wire steering, and you'll understand the level of refinement displayed by this car. Renault showed just how the super saloon of the 21st century could look with its elegant Megane. Powered by a 250 brake horsepower turbocharged V6 engine, this car has doors that slide down and front seats that swivel outwards, making access very easy indeed. And you won't see any rearview mirrors on it either. Three tiny television cameras connected to colour television displays on the fascia show exactly what is happening behind you. When it came to revealing what the supercar of the next century might look like, it was left to Peugeot with its stunning Oxia. This very businesslike machine is powered by a 680 horsepower twin-turbo V6 engine. The car has four-wheel drive, four-wheel steering and a body and chassis made out of carbon fibre and Kevlar. I went to the Toyota stand to see what they had to say about their FX-V2.
Yes, the FX-V2 is in fact our second generation concept car, and this one is used at international motor shows all over the world. Probably one of the main features on it is the most striking features is the new navigation system that it's got. This is satellite controlled, and it's also got an onboard gyroscope which backs the satellite up in case that malfunctions. That's displayed through a 10-inch screen. The driver's personal identification card will also program it for local maps, and it will guide him through the map screen, which is a further 6-inch screen, and tell the driver where he's going.
Can this system take into account factors such as accidents and roadworks when choosing a route?
Yes, it will do. That sort of information is fed in through the general direction system via satellite and via normal FM transmissions.
Do the systems for this already exist?
Certainly road warning systems exist now, mainly in Europe. All the Toyota cars from 1600cc upwards have that facility on the radios now. But unfortunately, it's not available as yet in this country, in the UK.
Not to be outdone, Ford had three concept cars. As a chat with them revealed, these were impressive.
We can give a glimpse of what the future may hold. We have three concept vehicles. We have the Probe 5, the Kia Sagaro and the Bronco BM1. And they show visitors to the Ford stand in the 1988 British International Motor Show with a glimpse of the future. Probe 5 is a 2+2 mid-engine car with the accent on aerodynamics. It's a very slippery car. It has a drag coefficient of 0.137. It's more aerodynamically efficient than a supersonic F-15 military jet aircraft. Its power is provided by a turbocharged 1.9-litre, 16-valve, four-cylinder engine, and it's mounted transversely and driving the rear wheels through a four-speed plus overdrive automatic gearbox. It looks as though the glass is all in one piece, the windscreen, the side glass and the rear windscreen. The wrap-over sliding doors allow easy entry and exit to the car.
The Kia Sagaro's designers also pay particular attention to aerodynamic efficiency, utilising techniques such as flush-fitting front and rear screens, door glasses, flush exterior door handles and steeply raked windscreen. The interior features a 2-3-2 seating arrangement, and with both rows of rear seats folded flat, the interior cargo room is as spacious as that of any estate car. The rear tailgate extends deep into the roof, allowing exceptionally large objects to be loaded into the cargo area. The Bronco DM1 is aimed at the enthusiast market for whom four-wheel drive and room for five passengers would be important. The vehicle incorporates satellite navigation and other useful features such as a quick-read extra set of instruments just below the windscreen.
That report by Paul Stimpson.
Now to the British Government white paper on broadcasting, entitled Broadcasting in the 90s. It's a 45-page document, but these following are the only two pages which are dedicated to radio. Radio is a valued part of the lives of many people. It has a lively character and an importance all of its own. It now faces great opportunities for development and expansion. Spectrum for many additional services will become available between now and 1995. Decisions were needed on how the spectrum was to be used. The case for substantial deregulation of independent local radio is compelling. There is much evidence of demand and potential for additional services. It's feasible and healthy to expose the BBC to competition in the provision of national radio services. Against this background, the government published in February 1987 its Green Paper, Radio, Choices and Opportunities. At the national level, the Green Paper saw a continuing need for public service radio broadcasting provided by the BBC, but proposed that side by side there should be an additional national radio service provided on commercial lines to introduce diversity and the stimulus of competition. At the local level, it proposed that the BBC should be able, subject to overall resources available to the corporation, to complete its chain of local stations, as it's now proposing to do, but that local independent stations, including new community radio services, should operate under broadly the same, much lighter regulatory regime as envisaged for new national services. At both levels, broadcasting should increasingly take place without unnecessary simulcasting, in other words, where the same service is broadcast at the same time on more than one frequency. There were over 500 responses to the Green Paper. They confirmed the view that the time was now right for a major change. The government, therefore, announced on the 19th of July 1988 that it intended to bring before Parliament legislative proposals based with some modifications on the Green Paper. In outline, the government's proposals are as follows. There will be scope for at least three new national commercial services operating alongside the BBC. A new VHF frequency will be available for one of these services. The BBC's existing Radio 1 and Radio 3 MF frequencies will be reassigned for the two other. The BBC will retain sufficient frequencies to broadcast its national services, whose editorial content it is seeking to strengthen. The new national services and independent local services will be subject to a lighter regulatory regime. They will not be required to comprise education, information and entertainment, although they may follow a public service pattern if they wish. Programme operators will be responsible for their own services, subject to requirements of taste and decency, and of avoiding editorialising and giving undue prominence to views on religious matters or matters of political or industrial controversy. At the local level, licensing criteria will include financial viability, local audience demands, and the extent to which the proposed services would enhance the range of programming and the diversity of listener choice. National services will be expected to provide a diverse program service calculated to appeal to a variety of tastes and interests and not limited to a single narrow format. The proposed competitive tender procedure for national services will be subject to this test. National and local services will have to keep their promises of performance in order to retain their licences. In the interests of preserving a competitive radio broadcasting market, no group will be able to control more than one national service and more than six local services. There will be a 20% limit on radio interest in newspapers and vice versa. The government will seek flexibility by setting these limits in subordinate legislations. There will be transitional arrangements striking a balance between the legitimate interests of existing stations and the importance of not delaying bringing any new stations onto the air. A new slim radio authority will be responsible for assigning frequencies and issuing licences to and supervising the performance of all independent stations. Advertising and sponsorship will be more flexibly supervised. Stations will not generally be able to receive public authority funding, but there will be clearly defined exceptions. Stations will be responsible for their own transmission arrangements and will be expected to broadcast on a single frequency, unless there are good reasons to the contrary. The number and scale of local services will depend on local demand and wishes. The government's proposals will create an environment in which community radio, based on a combination of local identity and cultural diversity, will be able to fulfil its potential. The government also proposes to provide for any satellite radio services for direct reception to be regulated by the radio authority under its light regulatory regime. In the case of satellite programming delivered to stations, radio authority regulation will bite on the stations taking the service. The authority will also license miscellaneous radio broadcasting services, such as special event and university radio. There is scope for a considerable expansion of radio services and a much wider range of listener choice. The government proposes to help these developments by deregulation and the provision of a new enabling framework. At the same time, the consumer protection requirements, which safeguard minimum standards, will be retained. Public service radio broadcasting will continue under the aegis of the BBC. BBC radio services will continue to be funded from the licence fee for some years to come. But BBC radio services will be subject to a much stronger stimulus for competition. The government's proposals will create the conditions for an expansion of radio which should benefit broadcasters, advertisers and listeners alike. In the meantime, the government, as a step towards the new radio arrangements, has endorsed proposals by the IBA for a limited number of additional stations operating under present legislation. In May 1988, the House of Commons Home Affairs Committee published a report on the government's plans for radio broadcasting. The government's white paper response noted the committee's approval of the proposal to establish a new radio authority and agreed with the committee's recommendation that the new radio authority should be funded and staffed sufficiently to enable it to carry out its functions effectively. The government also welcomed the committee's comment that the proposals that the new national stations should offer a diverse, but not necessarily general or untargeted, programme service, and that these should be allocated by competitive tender, struck a proper balance. Those were the only two pages of the latest government white paper's broadcasting in the 90s, dedicated to radio.
Standing at the crossroads, trying to read the signs, to tell me which way I should go to find the answer. And all the time I know, plant your love and let it grow.
Let it grow, let it grow.
Let it.
Get used to listening to AM signals through a synchronous detector, you will find it quite painful if you have to go back to an envelope detector. The improvement in signal-to-noise ratio and reduction in chatter from adjacent stations is particularly helpful on weak or fading signals. We produce a complete boxed phase-lock synchronous detector, which accepts 455 kHz IF input to suit many receivers. The two audio line level outputs can be fed into a hi-fi stereo system, and the four front panel controls allow reception of double sideband, upper sideband, lower sideband, stereo spread or independent sideband with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and improves the audibility of weaker co-channel signals, and finally, a low distortion envelope detector. Apart from all this, there is also an audio level controller, which counteracts the objectionable surging in loudness as the carrier goes through a selective fade and the automatic gain control in the receiver unnecessarily increases the gain. The unit costs £150, and a detailed four-page information sheet is available if you send along one 14 pence British stamp or one international reply coupon to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG.
This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime, with Holly Robson
and Trevor Brooke.
And now to reply to that white paper, Report from the Independent, by Alistair Milne. Down the US Road, it's called. The white paper on the future of broadcasting has received a mixed reception. The BBC has been restrained in its comments. The chairman of the IBA has predicted near anarchy in our broadcasting system. Only the Murdoch press and the advertisers have given it a full-blooded welcome. This shouldn't be surprising, because the white paper bears all the hallmarks of the continuing struggle between the Department of Trade and Industry and the Home Office that has characterised this government's approach to broadcasting. Nowhere is the tension more vividly revealed than when the white paper comes to deal with ITV. There is talk of the government not seeking to lay down a blueprint, of there no longer being the same need for quality of service to be prescribed by legislation or fiat. When there are 10 or more channels within reach of the average viewer, he or she can increasingly sort this out for themselves, provided that the choice before them is sufficiently varied. In short, let the market flourish. Yet within a few lines, other voices are laying down positive programme requirements for the new franchise holders in the Channel 3, which will replace ITV. The white paper claims they are not as extensive as those now governing ITV, and they seem to me virtually the same. A demand for regional programming, now to be a statutory requirement, for high-quality news and current affairs programmes in peak time, for a diverse programme service, a minimum of 25% of original programming from independent producers and so forth. It might almost be the dear old IBA speaking. Moreover, where we now have the IBA and the Cable Authority in positions of oversight, we are soon to have three such bodies: the Independent Television Commission, a new slim radio authority, and the Broadcasting Standards Council, which not only appears to take away considerable powers from the IBA, but from the governors of the BBC as well. A document cobbled together without the competing views of the two departments of state hardly seems a good prescription for British broadcasting. So what is the BBC to make of all this? On the radio the other day, Douglas Hurd claimed they should count their blessings, and they probably are. Reassuring words about the BBC's special role and a repetition of the Home Affairs Committee's statement about the BBC being, for the foreseeable future, the cornerstone of British broadcasting, are matched by gleeful comments about the double squeeze on the BBC through indexation of the licence to the Retail Price Index. Moreover, the government rejecting the advice of its own consultant, who argued cogently that the licence fee should not be replaced by subscription, has taken a huge crowbar to the cornerstone by pressing the BBC down the road of subscription. When we were discussing all this with the Peacock Committee 3 years ago, we pointed out that for the BBC alone to be available on a subscription basis would clearly damage it in time. We were confident that our programmes would attract subscribers competitively if all services were on subscription. But who would pay if the other services were free by being supported by advertising alone? And if it is to be subscription, who's going to pay for BBC Radio, which now consumes just under 30% of the licence fee? Mr. Hurd did not seem to have an answer to that one. The truth is, the white paper is full of inconsistencies and bids fair to do a demolition job on the public service broadcasting in this country. Where it is consistent is in its approach to advertising. It is, in fact, an advertiser's charter. No wonder they are hugging themselves with glee. The pressure they deployed to reduce their costs and increase their opportunities was bought for a time by the Peacock's dismissal of advertising on the BBC. It has worked with a vengeance now. The running motif of the white paper is the extension of advertising. In a reformed ITV, in radio frequencies removed from the BBC, in channels 5 and 6, and in additional satellite channels. Ironically, when broadcasting began in the United States, it was not thought that it would soon become what it did, a medium for advertising. It was the lesson of America that brought about our carefully regulated broadcasting structure. This government seems ready to return to first principles and take us down the American way of advertising. That was a comment written in The Independent by Alastair Milne, who was Director General of the BBC from 1982 to 1987.
And he referred there to the comments of Lord Thompson of the Independent Broadcasting Authority, and more comments by him reported by Shyama Pereira in The Guardian. Thompson attacks broadcasting plan. The outgoing chairman of the Independent Broadcasting Authority has attacked the broadcasting white paper for trying to achieve too much too soon. He promised to continue his criticisms in the Lords. Lord Thompson of Monifieth told guests at the Banqueting House in London, "There is a danger of trying to do too much too quickly, of destroying before there has been a chance for the new developments to show potential." Among the White Paper's proposals are a fifth national channel, two more satellite channels, the sale of ITV franchises to the highest bidder, a new independent television commission replacing the IBA, the scrapping of the BBC licence fee in favour of subscriptions and a new Broadcasting Standards Council. Lord Thompson, who retires next month after 8 years, urged the government to avoid change simply for the sake of ideology. "I plead with them to return to what I had always understood was the essence of the conservative philosophy, change with continuity." In the words of Oscar Wilde, defining the cynic, he said the government was in danger of knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing. He warned that successful public service broadcasting on ITV was more likely to be damaged by zealots in Whitehall than by satellites. And another short item about the IBA warning TVAM, which must improve its weekend children's programmes or face the possibility of losing its programme contract. However, the IBA also said that TVAM had made significant improvements in regional coverage, weekend news bulletins and programmes and programme presentation, which it had previously severely criticised. A short extract from something in The Independent by Colin Brown, their political correspondent, regarding the Queen's speech, where he says the Queen's speech was dominated by two major pieces of privatisation legislation on the electricity and water industries. The government has been forced to postpone some other controversial measures to avoid the programme being slowed down. Douglas Hurd, the Home Secretary, was disappointed at not winning time for his broadcasting reforms, including a bill to create three independent radio channels.
There was a time when the only route into BBC design department was after years of service in the corporation, but here's an interesting job advertisement for design engineers. The design group of the BBC's design and equipment department is looking for design engineers to work on a wide variety of projects for the BBC radio and television studios and for its transmitter network. The range of work is diverse, including analogue and digital processing of audio and video signals, software development for control applications and RF techniques. The department occupies modern offices and laboratory accommodation in Chiswick, West London, and has excellent technical and support facilities, including extensive CAD and CAE, and a comprehensive range of state-of-the-art test equipment. You should preferably have a good degree and some experience of professional design work in broadcasting or a related field. Starting salary will be in the range of £11,932 to £16,567, depending on experience and qualifications. For further information and an application form, contact David Kitson on 01747 4200.
Ads boost for Radio City in The Guardian. Radio City, Merseyside's independent radio station, made just over £1 million pre-tax profit in the year to the end of September, against £356,000 last year. Turnover rose by £1 million to £3.8 million, reflecting the growth in demand for local radio advertising space, said to have jumped about 40% in 12 months. The station is also benefiting from the expansion of the Merseyside economy, the chairman, Barry Marsh, has said. An 11.8% stake in Satellite Media Services, bought in April for £45,000, promises results next year when the local commercial radio network is due to quadruple in size with deregulation. Well, next year might be a bit optimistic there, I'd say. We'll be right back.
The Telegraph. Motorists warned not to use illegal radio car alarms. Motorists who use radio car alarms to beat car thieves were warned by the Department of Trade and Industry that they could be breaking the law and risking a fine of up to £2,000 and 3 months' imprisonment. Illegal alarms using the wrong frequency can interfere with radios used by the fire and ambulance services. Only one system, the Page Alarm produced by Seacom International, is approved and marked to show it conforms with the department specifications. The alarms, which cost about £100, transmit radio signals to small receivers carried by car owners should their vehicles be tampered with. Hundreds of the alarms are thought to be in use, and although it's not illegal to sell them, it is an offence to use them.
And also from the DTI, in the quote-unquote column of The Independent. I'm sorry about the man dying, but I'm sick of being hassled. A quote from John Paul, pirate disc jockey, when a government inspector had collapsed after climbing 14 flights of stairs to raid the pirate station.
Radio Fax will finish in December. We've been on the air for 4 months, and through that time you've been sending us over 100 letters each week telling us how much this kind of speech programming is appreciated. We also know that we have a fair number of very enthusiastic blind listeners. So, we remain a legal operation and close down in December unless some government writes us out the licence we've been asking for since 3 years ago. What would the other possible options be? We could stay on the air from the Republic of Ireland, or we could come on the air from England. By making public the time and place, this would be a fairly straightforward act of civil disobedience, and the presumably inevitable court case would form a part of the history of broadcasting. If hundreds of you write to say that is what you think we should do, then I suppose we would have to consider it seriously. But we have to make it clear now that these are not options we regard as compatible with a professional operation.
The letters you send are what has made this project worthwhile. And thank you again to everybody who has taken the trouble to write. We get letters from people aged between 17 and 70, and anyone in the media world will know that something appealing to such an age range is most unusual. Some of the historical items we have carried, the development of magnetic tape, the story of radar, old BBC transmitting stations, the invention of magnetic recording from wire recorders to digital tape, and others, have brought in letters from people involved in the work up to 50 years ago. If we were staying on the air, one thing we would have liked to do was organise a contact point so that people who worked together years ago could get in touch with each other again.
One thing we have achieved might be the most listened to programme per watt transmitted, and we mean listened to. Many shortwave stations are heard and logged, but your letters make it clear that people do listen to Radio Fax.
The use of shortwaves has fallen significantly over the last 20 years, and everyone seems agreed that, with a view to the future, what Radio Fax has demonstrated is now a useful and appropriate use of 9 kHz of the spectrum. What can you do? Well, if you think Radio Fax or something like it should be offered a licence, you could write to your Member of Parliament at the House of Commons, London, SW1A, OAA. And the ministers responsible are Douglas Hurd and Timothy Renton at the Home Office, Queen Anne's Gate, London, SW1H 9AT.
You are the people who know it's rubbish to say that no frequencies are available. There are a greater number of you using the HF spectrum for education and recreation than all other users put together. So your voice should carry some weight in decisions about what some fraction of it is used for.
To put the number of letters we get in context, it is more each week than the BBC Radio 4 Any Answers programme has been receiving recently. That's a response any station would be proud of.
Some of you might know that we had a letter from Lord Thompson of Monifieth on the 25th of October this year. For those of you who haven't heard it before, this is what he had to say. Thank you for your letter of the 14th of October about transmitting radio fax on HF from a transmitter in the United Kingdom. Unfortunately, we cannot help you because under the present legislation, Broadcasting Act 1981, as far as radio is concerned, the IBA can only transmit local sound broadcasting services. In your plan, you cover the British Isles. You probably know that the government intends to introduce legislation, probably late 89, early 90, which is intended to expand the opportunities for broadcasting. It would probably be prudent for you to press the Home Office to address the HF aspect. It has not featured in any discussions we have had with their officials. HF was also not mentioned in the Green Paper on radio. I'm sorry, we cannot help, but wish you good luck with your exciting project.
And now a look at some of the letters you've been sending to us. From Mackworth in Derbyshire. You may be interested to know that a new private shortwave station in Italy is due to start broadcasting soon on the 41-metre band, and I understand that they are interested in renting airtime. Wishing you every success for the future. Roy Patrick from Mackworth. Well, we do know about the IRRS. In fact, if you were listening back in August, you might remember that the general manager of IRRS, Alberto Cotronio, was listening to Radio Fax as he was driving around Wales and Cornwall on holiday. And then he drove all the way back to Italy, listening to our 1611 service. Anyway, we don't see any way in which we could make it break even on its costs. But Media Network had a look at IRRS.
Now, time for us to pick up the phone and call someone else for a change. We'll dial 39 for Italy, 2 for Milan, and then 266-6971.
IRRS, Italian Radio Relay Service in Milan. Potete lasciare il vostro messaggio dopo il segnale acustico, grazie. On Saturday and Sunday, November 19 and 20, we conducted tests on our transmitter on 7125, 7160, 9815, and 3945 kHz. These preliminary tests were to perform transmitter adjustments and to check our audio and modulation equipment. At this moment, we are considering whether we need to continue these technical trials before going into full program tests. More telephone information will be recorded on this answering service on Friday, November the 25th.
Rather than wait till tomorrow, though, we contacted the man behind that voice, Alfredo Cotroneo of the Italian Radio Relay Service Technical Department. They have plans to hire shortwave airtime to those who want to reach Central Europe. But building a 10,000-watt transmitter in the countryside brought with it some last-minute headaches.
We had problems with the electricity. The local electricity company was only able to give us, at the first stage, only 5 kilowatts. Then finally, it was 20 kilowatts. And we couldn't really switch the transmitter on with solar power. So we had to request an update in the power energy. And finally, we got that power last Friday. And on Saturday, we managed just to switch on the transmitter. Well, the installation was already prepared and everything was in order, but we couldn't test anything unless we had the electricity.
Last weekend, there were some successful tests, and even without prior publicity, the response was good.
Well, as I mentioned before, some people called, and we have reception reports from England, from Sweden, and from Holland. Simple was 44323 in Sweden on 9 megahertz. That sounds very good because the transmission wasn't mainly here to Sweden. Our main intent is to cover Central Europe.
And what's the power of the transmitter?
The power of the transmitter is 10 kilowatts. We are using A3A modulation, which is AM single sideband reduced carrier. We have reduced carrier minus 6 dB. This is a new way of broadcasting. This is suggested by the IBU, but used only by a couple of stations. If I'm not wrong, Radio France is using it and Radio Austria is. And one of the purposes of these tests is also to test the modulation, which is maybe one of the most important part of, except the transmitter.
I've got you. Now, you say you've tested the facility, but what people may have heard on air at the moment is certainly not what you're going to do in the future when you really start testing properly.
No, it's not the exact right program. You are just now putting pieces of programs. So We have the Italian pastor, the Italian preacher. We have the American religious organization. We have the good punchy music from World Music Radio. And we have also Radio Earth, which is a mixture of music and folks and many things. So we have to find the right balance between the different programming and tuning the audio processing and the modulation on the transmitter. Because after the test, our intention is to make everything automatic. There will be a computer and the station will be remotely controlled from here from Milan. It's a good side because it's up in the country, it's in a flat area, because obviously we cannot put up a shortwave station of that power here in the city centre of Milan.
That was Jonathan Marks there on Media Network.
And now to some more of your letters. We've heard from Mr. J. Murphy, who comes from Birmingham. He says, this is the first time I've come across your station. On the whole, it's very good. It fills a gap between pop stations and national features. All the very best for the future. J. Murphy.
I have in the past enjoyed information on shortwave, antenna and speed of light information most helpful. Hope you continue. Best of luck with a licence. From Kenneth Stockley from Bulkington, Nuneaton in Warwickshire, England.
M. Holloway from Bournemouth writes next. He says, I assume it's a he. I have enjoyed your programmes and urge you to continue your programme for as long as possible, but on a legal basis.
Alan Thompson from Wales writes, all good wishes and I trust that you will be successful in surmounting what seem to be inescapable difficulties. As a matter of interest, I've been a DXer since before World War II, and in the course of hearing and verifying over 200 broadcast countries, I can truthfully say that I have never heard anything that approaches your transmissions, apart from Radio Netherlands Media Network. Good for you in finding a really new format.
Over to Holland now, and we've heard from Julius Hermans, and he says, today I heard an interview with Trevor on Media Network. It was quite sad you sign off on December the 30th, and your last broadcast is on the 12th. Tragic, I think, as you really are good and fulfill a need for me and many other media enthusiasts, I think he says. Is there really no possibility to continue, perhaps in Italy? Anyway, I really like to thank you for many good, informative and high-quality broadcasts. Thank you, Julius.
From Sunderland and Roker on Wearside, I heard your radio show for the first time and I found it very interesting to listen to your item about satellites and communications and television and radio. Thank you, Kay Hartley from Sunderland.
F. Stampton writes to us from Humberside. A very interesting and informative programme. I'm sorry to hear you're going off the air in December. I'm an OAP age 74. Radio is my life, as I am disabled. Cheers and the best of luck from Phil Stampton in Humberside.
Hello, Bernard Whitty from Cathedral Sound, Horsall, Ormskirk in Lancashire. I have listened quite frequently to Radio Facts. I think I get as much, if not more, information about my own industry this way than from all the trade publications. I hope you get your licence. Bernard Whitty, thank you.
From Ivan Iclody in Sheffield, who in fact is age 64, says, I was disappointed to hear that Radio Facts has to close down in December 88 to remain legal. I have enjoyed your programmes about portable tape recorders and other technical information. I also liked your appreciation to the late Russell Harty. With best wishes for your future, yours sincerely.
Thank you for your letters, Kay Malcolm from Flixton in Lancashire, and Stephen Blanchflower from Walker, Newcastle upon Tyne, in northeast England. And from Blackpool, greetings from Blackpool. Quite suddenly, your station seems to have found its way onto my radio, around 6205, which is the frequency of my favourite shortwave station in Quito, Ecuador, South America. Thank you, Audrey McNeil from Blackpool.
Chelmsford in Essex is our next port of call, and we've heard from Keir Argent. We can hear you quite clearly on both 6205 and 1611 during the morning and night respectively. And also we've heard from Arthur Walker, who comes from Barkley in Gloucestershire.
Thanks, C. Foster from Early in Reading. And on Voice of Peace notepaper, Jörg Clemens Hoffmann from Gießen in the Federal Republic of Germany.
Thanks to Mr. R. Ness, who comes from Chesham in Buckinghamshire. He says he discovered our station by accident on 6205, listened for a few minutes, and then continued listening for about 3 hours. I found your programme content interesting and a pleasant change from normal broadcast stations. Thank you very much, Mr. Ness.
From Finland, Alpo Heinonen from Rovaniemi, who says it was really nice to listen to your programmes, wishing you all the best for the future.